Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the pod staff. With me tonight, I have Miss Summer Moon. So Summer and I know each other from working together for probably 2.5, 3 years. Mm-hmm. Summer has been an HR professional for over 20 years. Yeah. So yeah. I'll let you share a little bit about your background.
Cool. Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Of course.
So I've been in HR for 20 years, different companies, different industries, different points in time of where they are in, where I find joy is really building relationships with people mm-hmm. and, you know, carrying those relationships outside and kind of losing the stereotype that HR is the enemy yeah. a little bit. We're not. And I think it's being able to build relationships and trust and some of those things. So I'm really excited to be part of this world for you.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I've only had experience with maybe 4 HR mm-hmm. departments. And mm-hmm. I can tell you that dealing with you has always been a pleasure. And before we jump in, I just want to give her a little bit of gratitude because full disclosure, you know, whenever we met at the company that we met at, there was a point where I was going through a really rough time mentally. Mm-hmm. And Summer really, you know, I went to her office and I told her what was going on because I was trying to, you know, plan ahead and see, you know, what it might take for, you know, my mind to get right and stuff like that. And she was the one person that helped me to calm down and say, you might be feeling bad today, but what about tomorrow? Mm-hmm. Just want to say thank you.
Yeah.
So. With that, we're going to jump into first topic is going to be the leadership topic.
Yeah.
This is a really good topic. And we've got some funny things, I think, depending on how much we're going to share.
Yeah.
But kind of what I want to talk about with mm-hmm. the leadership is, you know, good and bad leadership for
yeah.
one.
Yeah.
Leadership styles and how leadership styles and leadership outcomes mm-hmm. affect your productivity. Mm. We were talking about, I want to mention this, the miss on compassion, because I think a lot of leaders are yeah. very strong leaders, mm-hmm. and they would be really good leaders if they just had some compassion for the people they were working for.
Yeah.
So I'll let you talk about that.
Yeah. And this one's hard. I think it's hard for people to step into because when we are so focused on business and business goals and KPIs and OKRs and all of the like alphabet soups or whatever, that we miss the part of, especially when we're in industries where people are the product, right? So you've got sales, you've got tech folks, you've got manufacturing. I mean, all of these people are who are driving our business. And for us to lose compassion that they are people, mm-hmm. I think is problematic. And I think if we step back and we realize that people are just people, and people have lives and they have things going on, and we're all trying to really get to the end goal, which is, you know, kind of build a world that's great for people.
Yeah.
That if we really just stop to think about how other people feel, then we are better. And I think when we create environments where people feel like they can show up as who they are, and they can have life problems, and they can have all of these things going on, and we create this sense of belonging, those people actually then show up more productive. Mm-hmm. They show up better. They show up willing to kind of like lean in even more. But if you create this space where people are just trying to survive,
yeah,
in all aspects of their life, you're not going to get the best version of them in any space. And in fact, they're actually going to put more energy into their outside life. Because right. that is really kind of where people spend the most of their time is in their outside life and where they should and where they should be finding satisfaction. And ideally, you would want them to find satisfaction with what they're doing, too. But
yeah, I think that's a touchy subject for a mm-hmm. lot of people because I think, I don't know the stats on it, mm-hmm. but I would say most people in the workforce, mm-hmm. they have experienced mm-hmm. the worst part of it, mm-hmm. not the leaders that are just so awesome mm-hmm. and that have really helped you. You know, yeah. I have the company we met at, mm-hmm. There's one leader I can think mm-hmm. of in particular that mm-hmm. really, he took me under his wing when mm-hmm. I got there. He showed me love, compassion, mm-hmm. and was still hard on me, yeah. all at the same time.
All at the same time.
And I have never sold at a higher clip than when mm-hmm. I was working for that man. I think that's just one of those subjects that a lot of people have just not a good mm-hmm. experience with. And
yeah.
I think I would like to know what you think would change some of that in leaders and mm-hmm. maybe how leaders and employees approach mm-hmm. each other. Because yeah. I think there's also, on the leadership end,
yeah.
there's also the intimidation factor
mm-hmm.
of leading a sales team
mm-hmm.
of 15 people. I mean, yeah. if you're leading 15 people in sales and your team is doing well, you've got some really high-end salespeople
mm-hmm.
and you have to, as a, maybe it's not a player coach, maybe mm-hmm. it's just the coach role, so mm-hmm. you're not getting that satisfaction of producing,
mm-hmm.
but your team is.
Yeah.
So I think there's a lot of pride that goes into that, but I'd like to know your thoughts on that.
Yeah. And it's interesting because there's always this kind of like top-down push with expectations, right? So whether you are PE-backed or you're private owned or whatever, there's their goals that we're meeting from a revenue perspective. And that gets pushed down and pushed down and pushed down.
Mm-hmm.
And there's stress involved with that. And I think sometimes leaders get so stuck in stress and then they push that back down. Whereas when I lead or if I'm leading a team, I try to help them understand why we're trying or like what we're trying to do and how we're trying to get there
the
and why we're
the
trying
what?
To get there.
Yeah.
And so I think giving them the full picture allows them to kind of see those areas where maybe they can lean in a little bit more. They can help or, I can delegate things down. But I think when you leave out the transparency, when you leave out the why, and you don't have to be fully transparent, like it's not realistic, but helping them understand the why behind what we're trying to do
mm-hmm.
and give them a sense of purpose into how they fit into what we're trying to accomplish,
mm-hmm.
I think that helps them understand, and they can see their position in the team and
yeah.
in the end game. And I think a lot of leaders just do this, like, well, it's because I'm telling this what I'm telling you to do. You can get by on a very short, short timeline there,
mm-hmm.
but a long timeline that won't last.
Well, I think that is because largely, especially in sales, mm-hmm. it's because you get salespeople out of college
mm-hmm.
and. Probably any industry. I'm just familiar with sales. So you get salespeople that are either fresh out of college or maybe they've had like one or two short-term jobs
mm-hmm.
and they get into a big fancy sales organization and they're like,
mm-hmm.
holy shit,
mm-hmm.
this is awesome. Whatever my boss says, it's great.
I'm making so much money.
Yeah, I'm making so much money. And it's like when they look back in 3 years uh-huh. and they're like, I don't think I could live off of that now.
Mm-hmm.
But... I think that's where you get those
mm-hmm.
those periods where
yeah.
you have people that will do things just
mm-hmm.
because they're told to do them.
Yeah.
But then whenever they start doing things over and over and get into their rhythm,
mm-hmm.
they say, wait, why is that happening?
Yeah.
I mean, I remember I did that all the time. I probably
mm-hmm.
wasn't the easiest person to lead
mm-hmm.
Because every single task that was given to me, I'd
mm-hmm.
say, well, why and how do you want me to approach this?
Yeah.
And...
But those
think,
are great questions.
Yeah. I mean, they are great mm-hmm. questions, but they're not received well a lot.
No.
So.
Because I think leaders, particularly if they're leading from ego or in really fast-paced environments where it's maybe harder to slow down, that is an ego question, right? So that then hits at somebody's ego, which is like, why are you asking why?
Especially if they don't know the answer.
Especially if they don't know the answer. And sales, I think, is an easier one to kind of create drivers for because there's commissions, right? So you hit targets
mm-hmm.
and there's commissions. When you get into maybe industries or positions that don't have those same kind of end goals in play, well, maybe they have a bonus, but it's a discretionary bonus.
Mm-hmm.
So like, okay, I'm going to bust my ass for, 12
Define
months.
Define a discretionary bonus.
So discretionary bonuses are, and a lot of companies have this structure set up where you have a potential bonus of say 10, 15, 30, 50% or whatever that could be. That's at the end of the year. If the company's done well, if you've done well in your performance review, like all of these factors come into play, you could get that bonus, but it's
mm-hmm.
not guaranteed. Whereas commissions, typically if you meet all your metrics, they're guaranteed because they're in a contract, they're kind of written in an agreement, etc.
Yeah.
A lot of other positions aren't like that. So you're banking on the company doing well from a revenue perspective. You're banking on hopefully you've done well in your role. Maybe it was defined for you. Maybe it wasn't. Maybe you know what your goals are.
Yeah,
perhaps
hopefully.
You don't. I don't know.
No, I've heard worse.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you're kind of banking on that you might get this thing at the end of the year, the beginning of the year after the quarter ends or whatnot. So the drivers are slightly different, maybe between sales and maybe say a non-sales.
Well,
position.
I want to hear about HR in that in that realm.
That one's a little harder because it's, and I found kind of with HR, maybe it might be an engagement metric, maybe it might be an attrition metric, it might be based on data-driven things or how well the company's done. But a lot of the times, that is a that should be a collaborative end goal, mm-hmm. which is HR doesn't control culture. We can help build things that maintain culture, but culture is a whole company. It is a whole company goal and mm-hmm. should be a whole company goal. It shouldn't be just HR. Your manager should be driving culture. Your executive should be driving culture. It's an everybody game. And so when it's left to HR to kind of build and you're doing pizza parties when maybe you're doing a cut every, you know, quarter, that's not going to work. It's not going to work. And this is where I say, like, when we lean into leaders and managers, building relationships with their people and figuring out what drives their people individually. So for you, it might be money. For somebody else who maybe has a younger family, it might be the flexibility to spend time with their family. Mm-hmm. For somebody else, it might be X. And so to apply kind of this blanket, like, expectation of, like, well, everybody just wants money or they want pizza parties or they want whatever, I think is a disservice to employees. Mm-hmm. And I think it's actually a disservice to the company because you're, I think, impacting potential utilization and productivity by not really learning what your people are looking for and how to lead them effectively and how to actually have good conversations and constructive conversations.
Mm-hmm. So if I'm hearing you correctly, mm-hmm. like, part of it is, you know, I've been a part of that from time to time mm-hmm. where it's like, why are we spending $7,000 on mm-hmm. a party mm-hmm. when, you know, maybe I want a piece of that $7,000, you know, mm-hmm. that's just an example.
Yeah.
But is that kind of what you're getting at? It's like, why are we spending money on this when I'm trying mm-hmm. to accomplish my end of year bonus?
Yeah.
And it's all about profit at mm-hmm. the end of the year.
Yeah.
I think for sales, it's about revenue, but mm-hmm. for the rest of the company, correct me if I'm wrong, but mm-hmm. it's about how profitable the company is.
It is, but I think there are those smaller things that you can do that at least show appreciation. And sometimes, you know, those small parties, those small moments in time, get people together, we can at least celebrate collectively as a group and collaboratively as a group. And I think those moments help still build culture.
Mm-hmm. So it's not always monetized.
It's not always monetized, no.
Mm-mm. So in the HR realm, because mm-hmm. with my sales background, mm-hmm. I have been around some very hungry for money mm-hmm. salespeople.
Mm-hmm.
And I like that environment.
Yeah.
I do. Especially whenever you get hungry for money, people that are actually really good people.
Yeah.
But not everyone cares about money. There are plenty of people that money is mm-hmm. just a means to do life.
Yeah.
And I'm jealous of those people sometimes. Mm-hmm. So is that what you see a lot in HR, where they just want a really good environment? Or mm-hmm. is it the salary that and the bonus mm-hmm. that makes people tick too?
It's all different. It's all different.
So what you're saying is you have to find as
it.
A good leader, mm-hmm. you have to find yes. individual people.
Yes.
And figure out what those individuals
yeah.
tick for.
Yeah, because I think when you do that, right, when you take the time to learn what drives people, when you find what makes them tick, you then build trust with mm-hmm. them, right? And I'm not saying as a leader you need to be everybody's best friend. I actually discourage that because I think you start to muddy some waters. But I think there's a line that you can get into where, you know, even with my team, like, I know what's kind of happening in their lives, generally speaking, enough to know that if I have one of my employees say, hey, this is going on, I need a day off, and I say, okay, great, then you need the day off.
Mm-hmm.
I don't, like, I build trust and, like, they trust me and I trust them to a certain extent where I can say, okay, then you need the day off. I'll talk to you tomorrow. Or is there anything that's hanging that you need me
and
to take off
you
your plate?
You don't text them and say, hey, mm-hmm. you've got to put in PTO. You got to go into the negative. Mm-hmm. You just say, hey, it's one. You're mm-hmm. having a bad day. You need it.
No. And I mean, there are those times where those conversations happen because there's just abuse of things.
Repetitive.
Like, that's,
yeah.
that happens. It is what it is. But I think generally speaking, people just live their lives. And I think if we just as leaders approach it with a little bit more empathy, a little bit more compassion for what's happening,
yeah.
again, then they turn around and show up even stronger for you. Because then you're building loyalty, because you're building this like belonging and environment where they feel okay to be who they are. And they feel okay to just have things happen in life. When you lead from ego, those things typically don't happen. I think you have to like have a little bit of a humble approach to yourself mm-hmm. as a leader.
Yeah, and I think, talk about ego, mm-hmm. some of the best leaders I've seen mm-hmm. have been the most humble people mm-hmm. with their team, but mm-hmm. anyone who's coming against their team mm-hmm. or anyone that they're trying to get their team to tap into mm-hmm. or anything like that, they're not so humble. Mm-hmm. They're dogs, mm-hmm. honestly. They're cocky and they get after it. But their team knows mm-hmm. their compassion. Mm-hmm. And if your team knows yes. your compassion, then they're going to get behind you whenever mm-hmm. you start a war.
Right. Yeah. Because they know that you will go to war for them too.
Absolutely.
And I think there's like ego and confidence, and I think sometimes people confuse the two. Mm-hmm. But being confident in your abilities and being able to show up for your team versus having an ego of like, I'm the best person ever on the planet. None of you know what you're doing, so I have to tell you guys how to do everything. That is going to create dissonance in your team. And again, you'll have some success, but eventually those people will exit. And there's the whole rule of like, people don't leave companies, they leave managers. Mm-hmm. It's not like entirely true, but it's mostly true.
Well, I like it better to say people don't mm-hmm. follow companies, they mm-hmm. follow good leaders.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because to follow a good leader mm-hmm. is different than to leave a bad leader. Mm-hmm. I think it's yeah. more about mission instead mm-hmm. of like, this shit sucks.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So as we move on from that, I want your 1 minute spiel of what HR is supposed mm-hmm. to be. Because I experience, mm-hmm. I hear a lot of things out from my friends mm-hmm. and family about how HR mm-hmm. just sucks. And it's like, oh, I hate dealing with HR. All that stuff. My experience with HR yeah. has been largely in my career you
mm-hmm. yeah
and it was like the best experience. Whenever I heard that, I was like, oh, these other people must suck if they're yeah. they must be really doing something wrong mm-hmm. but yeah. come to find out in other roles after mm-hmm. we stopped working for the company together
yeah
that's not the case. So yeah. anything you can clear up for our audience mm-hmm. here
yeah.
about what HR is supposed to be yeah. so that they can have ammunition for when they need something yeah. from HR, they need some compassion.
Mm-hmm. This is so interesting. I love this. So everybody, you know, there's the whole like HR isn't your friend like thing.
It's like a hashtag on social
media.
It's
a hashtag. HR is your friend. Here's the deal. We're not really anybody's friend. Our job is to, at least the way that I look at it, and this is different for, I think, you know, kind of every HR person when you look at it. The way that I look at it is it's my job as an HR leader to help understand the business, where we're trying to go, understand all of our goals and financially where we're at, and then help translate that into an employee strategy, but then also carry that information back up, right? So if I understand what's happening with engagement, if I understand maybe why we have a bunch of folks exiting, then I help look at that and I say, okay, we probably need to make some changes, that we need to some red flags here and there and create a strategy to help fix that. So my goal is to kind of sit in between all of these things and help just puzzle piece, problem solve it all together. Mm. And there's nothing wrong with HR and teams kind of going into the business and being friendly and understanding what's happening with people, because even, you know, I'll walk the floor and I'll sit with employees and I'll, you know, have conversations. And I think that's really the only way to truly understand what's happening, because they're not going to talk to you because there is that stigma.
Yeah.
And so you have to create this space where they feel invited.
How do you do that though? Because like you have an uncanny ability to mm-hmm. make people feel comfortable. Mm-hmm. And I love that about mm-hmm. you because that's what I experienced. Mm-hmm. But it's almost like, is it being an empath or is it just being saying, hey, it's not about me, it's about them.
Yeah.
Because most companies that I've you know, heard of that I have not worked for, maybe a friend has worked for, something like that, when HR walks the floor, everyone shuts the hell up. They don't sit and talk with you like your friend.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I remember sitting and talking with you like my friend, and, you know, you would be given, you know, handshakes and side hugs across the floor to anyone who came, and everyone was coming up to you. So how did you approach that differently than most of the HR departments in all these companies?
Yeah, I don't. I think it's just stepping outside of, like, you have to get out of your office. You have to get away from your desk and go to the floor and just say, how are you doing? And, like, it's the small, like, interactions over time that I think create that environment. But I don't just go out and be like, hey, let's just have a conversation. Let's go to happy hour. It really is just walking and being present. And I think that's it, is being present, showing up authentically, too. So I also just have a personality where I kind of just am, just like I just am.
You're calm.
Yeah.
You're calm.
And I want to say hi to people, and I want to understand what's happening, and I want to, like, I want them to feel okay in their space. Mm-hmm. And for me, I think that then creates an environment. If something's not happy in their space, they can come talk to me and we can problem solve it together. Now, I don't know what that end goal is. It's all dependent on what's happening. But, you know, for people to be like, I don't know what's, you know, what's going on with my manager. I don't know how to talk to them. Mm-hmm. And we just talk it through. And it becomes more guidance. It becomes more mentorship. It's not an investigation. It literally is just, I don't know how to approach this.
Yeah.
And we talk and they walk away and they go do something else. Mm-hmm. You know, and then everything's fine. But I think if you don't have that open space, you lose a lot of insight into what's happening with employees. And you lose a lot of insight into what's happening in the business.
Yeah. Now, that makes a lot of sense. I think we've talked a lot about the employee side of it.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to know for our listeners out here that are HR professionals, how to approach that. Because if I was an HR professional, I would probably be pretty intimidated to go out on a sales floor of 100 people and just start making conversations with people who are cranking out cold calls and doing all this stuff. And they're, some of them are like, what the hell are you doing talking? I know you work here. It's fine. But you got people to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of people would love some insight into how to do that to their team, or not their team, I guess their other departments that they're overseeing as well as their team.
Yeah. I think it's at every level. So, you know, when I work with executives, work with managers, work with leaders, you have to build trust at every level. And I think when you build trust at those other levels, like manager levels and leader levels, and when they encourage people to then go talk to HR, right? When your manager is saying, hey, you know what? HR would be a really good person to talk to about this.
Mm-hmm.
That's the environment that we want to create. And I think that, is, again, it's just building relationships. It's sitting with people. It's listening. Maybe you're getting teams together, you know. So maybe we're, you know, sitting and talking to a team about, hey, how is everything going? You know, we're doing kind of, you know, leader assimilation meetings, which is, what's working? What's not working?
Mm-hmm.
What would you want to see change? And then the action from that, and where people, I think where companies in general, because it's not just HR, it's companies in general, where they fall short is not taking then action on that feedback.
Mm-hmm.
So I think lack of action versus like survey fatigue.
Yeah, I think we have both seen some of the same things where someone has been brought to HR, not once, not twice, but maybe 3 to 5 times.
Mm-hmm.
And the people who are bringing them are being so bold as to talking about someone maybe being creepy in the workplace, maybe, maybe, you know, making them do something they didn't want to do that didn't make sense for after they asked, you know, some, anything.
Mm-hmm.
And it just doesn't happen as soon as they do it. And they're expecting to come in and just, they've built up the courage. They come in, they tell you exactly what's going on.
Yeah.
And then 6 months later, that person is still working in their same job, making more money than they were before.
Yeah. And some of that is, you know, some of their time in investigation and some of those things. But the way that I look at it is, if I feel very strongly about something, then I'm going to approach it from a very strong place and mm-hmm. a very strong opinion of like, this is a problem. It's a liability. It's all of like all checklist, all of it. But ultimately then sometimes it's up to the company to decide whether they want to take that risk or not.
And who in that company decides that?
It could be a number of people.
Really?
Yeah.
C-suite or investors or?
It's a number of people. Okay. Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. Okay.
But eventually those things will sort themselves out.
Yeah.
Some of it is timing. Some of it's, I mean, I'm not making excuses, but I'm just saying sometimes it's not as black and white as people think it is. There's a bunch of things happening on the back end as well. So conversations, things that might need to be put in place. So.
Yeah, because people expect that they walk in, tell you a problem, and you walk out and take care of the problem. Mm-hmm. And there's more red tape than that.
And sometimes it is that black and white. Sometimes it very much is that black and white. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's not.
Yeah. Well, thank you for that insight on the HR side of things. I do want to move on because you're not only an HR leader, you are a being that is so present yet so extended into the world and all these different things. Mm-hmm. So I do want to talk about your next move. When it comes to like making your next move and just finding that next fit for you, for someone who doesn't have a big financial backing, you know, what's the point where you say, I need money right now and I know I'm overqualified for these jobs, but maybe I have to take one of them.
Yeah.
And maybe it's the time value of money that says, if I take this right now, 3 months later, I could get a better job that in a full fiscal year cycle could actually get me more money than this one would if I take it now. So what's your thoughts on that?
Yeah. One, I think the market right now is really interesting, right? Because you've had a ton of layoffs with Verizon. You've had a ton of layoffs in the tech space. You've just had a ton of companies doing layoffs. So there are more people in the market now than there have been in the past. And so I call it a buyer's market from an employer standpoint. And so the employers could be a little bit more specific, a little bit more, you know, particular on who they're bringing in. And so I think there are going to be a lot of folks that take positions that they normally wouldn't take. Maybe they're looking at it as settling into a position to support their family and their bills and all of those things. But they will continue to look for that next thing that then fits, whether it's their, you know, salary goals, growth goals, whatever that could be. So I think you're going to see a lot of people doing a little bit of that and or working, starting to work side gigs or taking jobs that they might not normally consider taking to have financial stability. But then I think we'll see a shift. And so there's this balance between do I take something now and in 3 months? And I think some people just have to. I think there are people that have to, and I think there are people that can hang out a little bit and maybe wait for that next like dream job. Mm-hmm. But from an economic standpoint, I think most people are in that first category.
Okay. That's good to know.
Yeah.
And does that tie in with the ego death?
I mean, there's a little bit of it. Yes.
Let me preface it because I left my job last month.
Yeah.
So I'm in between full-time jobs right now. And I have, you know, the jobs that I've applied to, I've been declined in a matter of minutes from companies, from jobs that like I'm overqualified for.
Right.
And maybe I didn't realize it till after, and I saw that. I was like, wait, why did I get declined? Mm-hmm. And then I started applying to jobs, like entry-level account executive jobs and stuff like that, that I'm way overqualified for. Mm-hmm. And I still get those same rejections.
Yeah.
So I don't understand that. I mean, that just shows me that we're living in a world that a lot of humans are not taking a look at our resumes and our personality. They're not taking the time to meet with us before they actually make a decision on who they're going to. And I wonder if my resume was this and your standard was this, then who are you saying yes to?
Yeah. I don't know. And it's really interesting because the market's saturated from a like candidate perspective. And I'm actually seeing this in, you know, HR groups that I, you know, I'm a part of, and we have these conversations. You're just going to see people that I think you're going to then see a little bit of like job hopping and job movement. Maybe it's 6, maybe it's 12 months from now, mm-hmm. when maybe the market shifts slightly.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of lean into AI and why people are making some of the decisions they're making. I think you're also leaning into, you know, people hired too fast. They have too many people for what they actually need. So there's a ton of reasons why these things are happening, but it's unfortunate. And I think you are going to see folks who might be wholly qualified to do these, you know, really high level positions that are saying, okay, yeah, maybe I just do need to go work at Trader Joe's for a little while because I need to be financially stable. And I will tell you, I will go work at Trader Joe's because those people are phenomenal. And then I would get to taste test things. So
sponsor her. Trader Joe's, sponsor this podcast, please. You said a quote to me one time and it really stuck with me.
Okay.
Rejection is redirection.
Oh, yep.
And
yep.
That's like maybe cliche. I mm-hmm. don't know. I've never heard it before, mm-hmm. but in a concept it might be.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about that. Like, why is that a quote that just spewed out of your mouth?
Gosh. And this is one where I lean to it. And there are a couple of other concepts that I lean into with this one, which is the ego death one is one of them.
Yeah.
Because I think when we feel rejection, when we get rejected, whether that is personal relationships, it's jobs, it's whatever it could be, I think we tend to look at that as a self issue, right? Mm-hmm. And then we go, okay, what did I do that wasn't good enough, or why am I not good enough? And I think if you flip it into it's redirection, which just means whatever that rejection was just meant that it wasn't for me long term.
Yeah.
So you can look at it as, you know, if I didn't get this job, if I was rejected from this job, something else is on the horizon that is better or that I need to focus on. I may not know what that is now. That doesn't pay the bills, so sometimes that sucks.
Yeah.
But I think then you go, okay, then maybe I just need to figure out what this moment in time looks like for me, because there's something better long term for me. And I think you can do that with personal relationships too, which is whatever relationship didn't work out for you. You know, we can lean into romantic relationships specifically, just meant that something else better was for you in the horizon. Mm-hmm. Hard to see at the time because that shit sucks.
Yeah, there's blinders, just, right? It's a knife in the heart. It doesn't matter if the relationship was for you or it wasn't. Maybe you even knew it wasn't for you.
Yeah.
When it ends, it sucks.
It also sucks. Have to grieve it, and you have to be like,
and you don't even want to grieve it. You just have to.
Yeah.
And if you don't, then you're going to grieve it later with someone else, and that's not going to work out.
That's not going to work. Don't put that shit on anybody else. God. Your trauma is not my responsibility.
Yeah.
But I think when you look at it that way, which is really hard because that requires you to step outside of like yourself a little bit and say, okay, this has nothing to do with me.
Yeah.
That just means something else is better. I need to trust God, universe, source, whatever you want to call it. That I'm just going to trust that there is something better for me and I'll figure it out in the meantime.
What do you say to a 26-year-old
mm-hmm.
Guy or girl
mm-hmm.
that has dealt with rejection?
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's relationships,
mm-hmm.
I think a lot of people in their 20s are mm-hmm. going to deal with that more. So, relationships, yes,
yeah.
but more so it's going to hit home whenever it's mm-hmm. it's career-wise.
Yeah.
And maybe they know that they're capable of something, mm-hmm. And someone has told them that they're not.
Mm-hmm.
So that belief, you read the book, The Four Agreements?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, so don't take anything personally is one of the four pillars of the four agreements.
Yeah.
That is a wonderful concept.
Conceptually phenomenal.
But shit, it is not an easy thing to do.
No, it's not. It's not. And I think there are ways for people to kind of find and build community that then will help with that. And especially, I mean, kind of when we find things that fill our cup and our soul, then those things I feel like could hit less or maybe have less of an impact. So if you're finding hobbies and things that you really like to do and you find community, I feel women tend to build community maybe better than men, just because we do.
No, it's
because
natural,
we're built
yeah.
on friendships. Mm-hmm. And then you can, when those things happen, when you do have rejection, whether it's romantic relationship, job, career, whatever, you can lean into those things and you get your cup filled through that. And then you can figure out the stuff on the end. But if you don't have other things to lean into, you don't have other things that are filling your cup, and then this is your only identity, that's where I think people struggle.
And
that's
I've struggled with that.
Yeah.
And one of the biggest things I've struggled with recently is, and you don't even realize it's happening at the time. When I got to the company that we met at, I was making squat, you know. I didn't care. Yeah. I was coming off of a bad point in my life, just kind of a down point. And I got to the company. I didn't care what anyone else was making. I didn't care. Nothing. It was just, I want to be here, and I want to make an impact, and I want to help people, and I want to sell a product that helps people.
Yeah.
And it did. I believe that it did because I wanted it to. But somewhere along the way, I remember I had a conversation actually when I got to the company that we met at. And I asked someone, what makes you tick? Immediately she said, money. And I said,
yeah.
Okay, why? And she's like, because money allows me to do things. And I said, well, isn't that sad at night whenever you go to sleep? And then fast forward a few years later, and I'm thinking about money. I'm checking all my investments. I'm checking my Schwab account. I'm checking my 401k.
Yeah.
I'm like, money just hit. I'm going to move it here. I'm going to do this.
Yeah.
The last 3 weeks of my life has been trying to get out of that mode.
Yeah.
Because that is not a fun mode to be in. It sounds fun whenever you're buying nice things and watches, and the enjoyment of those things is no longer enjoyment.
Yeah.
If the path to get there was
kills your
downgrading
soul.
Yourself. Yeah, it kills your soul.
Yeah.
So yeah. What do you think about that?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's what you have to figure out, kind of what is your purpose. And yes, there's means to an end. And yes, I think we have to, like, you know, it's capitalism at its finest, right? Which is like, we need money to buy the things that we really like to do. And then we like to do those things, and now we need more money because we want to keep doing this. It's just this perfect circle of
just upgrading your lifestyle.
Just capitalism.
Yeah.
So I think that's finding those things outside that drive your purpose, then I think help you figure out what you might want to do from a work perspective.
Yeah.
But I mean, I love to travel, and I like to do I need money. I need money for those things. Therefore, I like money. But I also want to enjoy what I'm doing while making money. So I won't work at a company that is toxic, or that I have a toxic boss, or whatever those things are. So you have to figure out what that balance is, and what, like, just what your purpose is and what you're willing to sort of sacrifice to get to do the things that you really want to do.
How do you not lose yourself in that, though? Because what I gathered from that is work to live, not live to work.
I mean, ideally, we would like to live. But that is not the reality for a lot of people. Right? It just isn't. So ideally, yes, I would like, theoretically, I would like to do that. I am lucky enough to be able to do some of those things. But the reality for a lot of people in this current environment, in this current economical space, is that they can't. And so if they can find those things outside that then bring them joy, I think you start to then balance out that, yeah, I have to work a job that I hate and it sucks. And, you know, I've got to work for a boss that I might want to kick his knees out.
Kick his knees out is crazy.
I've had a few. But you're finding purpose, and you're finding, like, things that you like to do and enjoy and all these things outside
of it. Kick his knees out. I've heard shoot his knees out. I've heard get rid of him.
I mean, did you ever, like, walk up behind somebody and just kick their knees out from behind them, and they just like.
That's why I never. I had it done to me after I had an ACL surgery one time, and after I did that, I had that happen to me. I was like, why would I do this to someone? It made me so mad.
Yeah. My other favorite is punch them in the throat, but I felt like kick their knees
out. I like
punch
them in the throat. Yeah. I used to tell my team that at the last company I was at, I was like, we're going to kick our competition in the throat.
Yeah.
And as soon as they're down, we're going to stomp on them. We're not going to look back.
Yeah.
And we're going to do it morally.
Really?
Somehow we're going to do all that, and we're going to do it morally.
So
that's going to be perfect.
I think it's hard for a lot of people to be able to, like, actually do the things that they really want to do because they're so stuck in this environment where they're just, like, constantly paycheck to paycheck. So in those spaces, that community and that finding the things that you really like to do and maybe giving back, I think, are even more important.
Giving back, I like that. Mm-hmm. That's one thing I've been thinking about this year for just the holidays, stuff like that. And, you know, I know it may be a cliche time to do stuff like that, but I've never enjoyed the holidays. Mm-hmm. And just giving back in general, like that concept, I've tithed at church. I've given money to, you know, people that needed it. Mm-hmm. I've done all that good stuff. But I think when I look back, honestly, I did that stuff for me.
Yeah.
I didn't do that stuff for them. Mm-hmm. And this year, I think I'm trying to make a very conscious effort to go bless someone and not even let them know it's me.
No, I am wholly against, like, letting people know. And you can do it in such subtle ways. So one of the things that I do, if I go to the grocery store, it's easier to do it at Trader Joe's, but you can kind of do it anyways. When I'm checking out, almost at the end of when I'm checking out, I'll just ask the person at the register. I go, what's your favorite snack up here? What do you recommend? And then they ring it up and I go, and then I pay for it and then I hand it to them when I'm leaving.
That's
and it's the littlest things because...
That's a really good... It's just so simple.
It's so simple.
Because I think a lot of us think that we have to have these big extravagant donations or volunteer times, and it could be that.
And those things are also so important, where you can volunteer, maybe at the food bank or whatever it is. You don't have to put money into it, and this is where people think they have to spend money. If you can go volunteer at the food bank, or if you can go volunteer to pass out, you know, things at a food drive, or volunteer at a kitchen, whatever that is, or maybe it's fostering a dog or wherever you can figure out a way to kind of give back, because there are studies that show that when people do that, like, their serotonin and obviously goes up, and it's not for them, but then you just create this space of where, like, people are just continuously doing things for each other.
Yeah, they're welcoming that into their space almost. Yeah.
And karma is a bitch, so she will come for you.
So the next thing I want to talk about, Summer, is emotional currency, your emotional bank, putting deposits in your emotional bank, and then the transactions that deplete your emotional bank. And I want to tie that in with a wonderful concept that you have called purpose and being.
Yeah, so emotional currency. This topic came up years and years ago. I had a partner. We were having lunch, and there was kind of an old man having lunch, and I wanted to pay for his dinner just as kind of, not tell him that we did it, just do it and just be done and leave. And we actually got into a fight about it, like a fight for no reason.
You wanted to pay, he didn't want you to pay? Okay.
And I guess he went and had a conversation with one of his really good friends and then came back and introduced this concept of emotional currency to me via his friend. So one of the good things I got out of that relationship, but whatever. So it really is just the concept of...
Anything else?
It's really just the concept of the effort that you make, like, emotionally, and where you're spending your emotional, just, like, bank. And like road rage, right? So people get, like, viscerally angry in road rage. I don't know, we've all been there. And, like, I get, when people cut me off, I'm like, that's solid. Good on ya. But there's no ROI on road rage and anger and the emotional expenditure that you have there. There's just not. So what we spend in our emotional just life, so this could be romantic relationships, work, where we put our time, where we put our effort, how much we put into other people. My other favorite phrase is, what other people think of me is none of my business.
I love that phrase. You said that to me the other day.
I didn't make it up. Let's just be clear. I did not make that up. But I think that's that emotional currency part, is if I'm spending all of my emotional bank on what other people think of me and trying to impress people, trying to worry about other people, think I'm just depleting. So if I think about, I want to spend my money, I want to spend that emotional bank in places that make sense for me, that make sense for specifically me, who I am, what my purpose is, what I want to do in life. Am I getting it back from others, right? So if I'm spending time with people who are overly negative or overly angry, who just are like the pessimists of the world, I have to then spend that emotional bank navigating with them and like being like, oh, but it's not that bad. Like, and then spending time there where I go, that's not really worth it. Or maybe I just spend a little bit of time there and I spend a little bit there, but then I have hobbies and other things that then fill my emotional bank. So I think you just have to figure out what that is for you and where you fill your cup and where you then pour out to others. But it has to be this constant exchange. Otherwise, then you're pouring from an empty cup. I don't know if you've ever heard that statement too.
Yeah,
it's like you can't, like if it's empty, what are you pouring?
Nothing's coming out. Yeah.
Air doesn't fill up anything other than people with hotheads. But
air doesn't fill out anything.
Yeah.
Other than people with hotheads.
And hot air balloons. But anyways,
there's
some flaw in that statement.
I mean, it could be something. It could be something good. For the average person like me, very average, I would have to think about that quote for about 7 minutes before I got it. I still haven't gotten it, but I get what you're saying, I think, maybe. I don't know. Fuck it.
But I think it's like, it's the emotional bank. And I think that the whole, like, what other people think of me is none of my business is also what we talked about, ego death, is where you have to really step back and start investing in things that are for you. Mm-hmm. So if that is like, again, if we talk about kind of like settling for a job, I might have to like temporarily say, this isn't for me, but it's for my future. Like I have to get to point B. So there's some stuff in between that I need to do. Just
so you're
to make
almost
sure.
Like taking care of your future self just because you know you'll need it. At that point. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think people need to step back and say, okay, where am I spending my money?
Yeah.
I mean, you can even say this like just financially in general with real money. Is where am I spending my money? If I want to go on all of these lavish trips, maybe I'm not doing this over here because I want to spend my money to go do X. Mm-hmm. Emotional currency is a little bit harder because it's not tangible, right? So it's just conceptual. And I think a lot of people will spend money or time and emotion and
emotional
all of these
money.
Things.
Yeah.
On areas that don't then fulfill their purpose.
Yeah. So what's an example of that for you?
For me, it was learning when to walk away from certain situations. Mm-hmm. That could be a job. So, you know, I've walked away from, you know, jobs that weren't fulfilling me emotionally and were actually draining me emotionally. And also just romantic relationships where they weren't actually adding to, and I was expending like more capital in those than I was getting back, and I didn't see really a long-term thing. So you have to be okay with walking away.
Yeah, I think, you know, people say that in sales, they say it in relationships, they say it pretty much in any realm, and it looks different everywhere. Mm-hmm. But I think just for our audience, I want to know about the relationship portion of it because, you know, whenever you're real young and everyone's, you know, chasing each other and stuff like that, you know, the girls are attracted to the guys that don't respond and all that. So they're ready to walk away, like all that stuff. But it leads to different things in the future.
Yeah.
And some of that little childish behavior carries over into whenever you're in your 30s and you have a relationship that they're acting like the relationship you had whenever you were in high school.
Yeah.
So tell me about that for your experience.
Gosh.
Goodness.
I think it is for everyone, individually, you need to look at what are the things that are really important to you? So you got height, money, like all of these things. Like from a character perspective, what is really important? Is it somebody who is kind? Is it somebody who's compassionate? Is it somebody who cares about others, wants to see you grow, is your champion, is your supporter, like all of these things? And if you aren't finding that, if you know you're having these conversations and this person is dismissive or they're defensive or they're not really, like, you aren't helping each other grow as two humans, that for me is not, that is not a transaction that makes sense to
me. So what do you say to all the people out there, and not to stereotype it, but more so women, mm-hmm. who think that they can save a man? And in a lot of cases, men who think they can save a woman. Mm-hmm. And it's not as common, but yeah. It still definitely happens. And when I say save someone, I mean, well, they get so drunk on the weekends, mm-hmm. that they black out. But mm-hmm. I just need a year with them, and mm-hmm. I can turn them around.
Yeah.
You know, stuff like that.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. I am not a relationship expert, obviously. However, this is all so individualistic that it's really hard to have this blanket statement to it.
Obviously, you said.
I think people need to look internally and figure out what is important to them. And if you look at someone and say, but, you know, 50% of them is good. It's like, right, but you wanted 100%. Mm-hmm. So are you settling for 50 because you feel that's all you can get?
What's a realistic number, though? Because I feel like my therapist has told me before, mm-hmm. that there is always going to be a percentage.
Absolutely.
And I said, what's a percentage? Maybe I can calculate it. You can't. She was like, I don't know, it's different for everyone. And I'm like, well, you're the therapist.
All right,
you
Bill should Nye,
definitely
chill out.
Be telling me exactly what
no,
to do, right?
It's not an equation. It's not a math thing. It is an inward thing that I think people need to look at and say, this is what for me makes sense for me to be with, and what I feel like is the best compatibility partner for me. Hmm. And if at any point you start going off of that and making excuses, I think you just need to look and say, okay, is this something I'm willing to trade? I'm willing to spend a little bit more money over here, a little bit more emotional currency over here, because I truly can see that the end of it and that ROI is worth it. Mm-hmm. Not all of it is, and so I think it's just all circumstantial. So I can't put a blanket statement on it, but I think a lot of people end up settling because they think that is, for them, it's a self-esteem thing of like, I can't find better. Mm-hmm. And I think you just have to balance that out.
And don't you think that sometimes people make other people, mm-hmm. think that they cannot do better, when the only reason that they're making them think that, mm-hmm. is because they know they can do better?
I mean, manipulation at its finest.
Yes, it is. That is the word. Thank you.
Here's the thing. I think if everybody took 5 steps back and they really looked at themselves and their purpose and who they want to be and what they want to push out to the world, you need to find a partner that supports that. So, yes, people are manipulative, but if you start to see those things, I think as long as you're true to yourself, and I think this is where people start to, like, they get off that line. They're like, but I maybe over here, it's fine. It's like, then you're not being true to yourself. Mm-mm. So whoever you are, whatever that is for you, whatever that version is of you, if you remain true to yourself, then you find people that are aligned to that self. That's romantic partners, that's friendships, that's work. Like, so this is where, like, the purpose and the being, I think if you look at truly who you are, who are you at your core? Like, what do you want to do? Are you a person who likes to give back? Are you a person that finds community in others and sharing out externally, right? So if we talk about this podcast, So purpose for you, this podcast is being able to share people that you might know or what your voice is. If you're finding people that align with that, then you're on your mission. And people that don't align with that, you're going to see those people very quickly.
And maybe I've done a bad job of just real quick to describe the podcast, but let me just read my mission statement.
Please do.
For the podcast.
Yeah.
Because I think, you know, my purpose in this, for those out there that are starting a podcast, just know that you're not going to be starting it for monetary value. In fact, your currency, not your emotional currency, but your currency is going to deplete a little bit to get it started.
That's just the investment phase.
It's got to be a passion project, I think, unless you're someone famous
and
you're
like,
hey, I'm Matthew McConaughey, maybe I start a podcast.
Yeah.
The Podstaff mission, the business mission statement is to connect job titles to real life. We offer an unscripted look into the diverse careers and personal journeys of professionals. Our mission is to share candid, relatable stories about life, work, money, relationships, highlighting that every role is essential and every role ties in with personal life. Yeah. So thank you for allowing me to give my little spiel there.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think that's part of it, right? Is like now that you have established kind of what your intentions are behind it, and just who you are in life. And I feel like, you know, from conversations we've had previously when we've actually, you know, talked at our prior job and other conversations, you're starting to kind of come into who that really is and what your personal mission is. Not the positive, but what your personal mission is in life. And so staying on that path and finding those opportunities, and when those opportunities don't align, you're probably not going to lean into those. You're going to just say, okay, probably not for me. I'll look over here. But knowing that those things will come to fruition, because you're going to bust your ass like you always do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think the podcast is, I have been able to have a lot of experiences for being a very young man. A lot of those experiences came from me doing the absolute wrong thing and treating people poorly, and whether that was relationships at the time, friends at the time. I realized that it was all me. I'm struggling. I want to get better. I want to do this. Me. And eventually I had to say, all these conversations that I'm having with people who are helping me get better, wow, maybe now I should have those people connected with the world. And I think that might be its own mission statement.
Maybe.
Who knows?
Who knows? Yeah. But I think that's the emotional currency. That's just the concept of it, is like finding those things in your life that, you know, put in the bank, and then you find the things that you actually want to spend on. And that could be, maybe you are volunteering places, maybe you are sort of this, you know, emotional outlet for your friends, right? So I've friends that'll call me and we'll talk for hours at a time, and they're talking to me, and that is an expenditure on me, but there's ROI in it, the way that I look at it, because I'm then supporting my friends.
And then in turn, whenever your friends
absolutely
take your advice, I think when that happens, they show up for you more.
Oh, absolutely.
And I think that's the point where you say, are you my friend, or are you a seasonal friend? Are you my real friend or not?
Yeah. And I think men need to do a better job at that.
Yeah.
Men need to do a better job at finding community, because I think a lot of men spend more time pouring into their jobs because that's an easier identity, and less into being maybe fathers, husbands, support beings in other people's lives. I think men do it differently, right? They go on golf trips, they, you know, do these things, but you're not having conversations about what's happening in your life.
Yeah, real conversations. Right. And that's why, like, I feel very blessed. Mm-hmm. And I didn't do this in my early years, mm-hmm. but I do it now. And I'm very intentional of who my friends are. Mm-hmm. I have a group of 5 friends. Mm-hmm. We don't always hang out together. In fact, most of it's just one-on-one here, one-on-one there. Yeah. But they are friends that, like, I'm not interested in surface-level conversations unless it's maybe just to be cordial mm-hmm. at a social setting yeah. or something like that. I'm not interested in that anymore. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it sucks to not be interested in that anymore.
Yeah.
Because sometimes you, like, all the stuff that your brain was wired to think was fun, it's not fun anymore. It's mm-hmm. just not.
Yeah.
And I think that I'm just now thinking of this. Mm-hmm. It's probably because of my dad.
Mm-hmm.
My dad has been an engineer his entire life.
Yeah.
And he was always just a family-valued man. Like, he never wavered from that. Never mm-hmm. not once. Never was at the bar. Never, like, just all the stuff that you hear about families and men not showing up for their families. Mm-hmm. Never. And in my later years, he actually let me know, because I asked him, mm-hmm. not because he wanted to tell me. He let me know that he had some fun job offers, and mm-hmm. not even just job offers, but even mm-hmm. in his jobs, like mm-hmm. getting invited to Argentina for a dove hunt.
Mm-hmm.
But it was our weekend to be at his house. He is not going to mm-hmm. waste that time
yeah.
on that. I don't understand how... I still wrestle with that, because for me, I don't think I'd be there right now. But what a wonderful being mm-hmm. and just role model to be in my life, to show me that what matters, matters. And what doesn't, doesn't. And if you focus on what doesn't, then none of it's going to matter. It's all going to be gone. And wow, that's a wonderful concept.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You got that out of me.
I've got a lot of just kind of quotes that I lean into a lot. And one of them is control what you can control.
Mm-hmm.
Influence what you can't control. And the rest just... it just is.
Mm-hmm. It's like the Serenity Prayer too, mm-hmm, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And so I think if we, you know, if you kind of look at that and you tie it back to being and purpose and emotional currency, like, it all ties together, because there are things that you cannot control in life, and there will always be things that you cannot control. And so pouring all of this, like, energy into those things, it's not worth it.
Mm-hmm.
It's just not. So you just let those things be, and they just are.
I would like to tie that into any hobbies that you have, too. Because for me, mm-hmm. I love fishing.
Mm-hmm.
I love it. My uncle down in Beaumont used mm-hmm. to take me all the time to Sam Rayburn Lake. We'd go fishing, and we'd go on his bass boat. And, like, literally nothing else mattered at that moment besides, I'm going to catch a bass or something like that. And back when I was younger, it was just kind of like a, oh, I'm Texas boy type deal. But I look back and I think, dang, those were some really wonderful moments. And I shared a lot of those moments with my dad as well. Mm-hmm. And I've come to find out, hobbies are not so much about what you are feeling in the moment or doing in the moment. Yes, you're present in the moment, but it's more about, like, the community that you can build from that, and then not leaving those hobbies to be. Because I haven't fished in 2 years. One of my goals this week is to go fishing. I want to go fishing this week. I know it's Thanksgiving week, but I want to go fishing. I don't care if it's just one cast or not. Mm-hmm. I want to go fishing, because that's a hobby that maybe I'm not interested in anymore. I don't know. But I haven't even explored it enough to do so.
Yeah.
So tell me about your hobbies and how that helps you stay into the present moment.
Yeah. I think hobbies, right? I mean, we've kind of talked a little bit. What are you doing outside that's sort of filling your cup? And to hobbies, passion projects, wherever you're spending your time. And so for me, one of the things I do is I judge dance competitions, which is super
that's
fun.
That's awesome.
And has allowed me to actually travel to, like, all over the place.
Tell us where.
Gosh, I've been to 18 countries, I think. You know, so Scotland, Ireland, Prague, Budapest, like, I've just been to some really cool places that I wouldn't have been able to go to. Also, just such a great community. So the people that I judge with, I mean, some coach professional teams, they do choreography for TV shows. They've been in really, you know, famous dance groups. And so it's also just this really cool community. Travel is another one, and I know that's very cliche, but I really like hiking, so I'll, you know, go find a place to go hike at. But I just love the experience of culture and kind of immersing myself in those different, you know, parts of the world. And then build things. So I don't know, do we talk about build wine and whiskey racks? That might be.
You briefly mentioned your interest in bourbon racks, is what you said.
So I build those. So it's just finding.
So like with wood and kind of.
Wood.
Have you ever seen the ones that like kind of balance like a little snake?
I have not tried that.
That's crazy because it's literally just a plank with another plank, but it's like balanced so perfectly with the weight of the wine.
I feel like there's math involved in that and I'm not really.
Yeah, I'm not a big math guy. Math is one of my stronger suits, but even. That just says a lot about me. I'm not a big math guy, and that's one of my strong
math
subjects.
No, math is a verb. I don't math. But I think it's finding, and it's also just hanging out with friends and experiencing and doing just life in general.
Yeah.
But I feel like those are the things that add into the bank.
Your emotional currency.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, kind of the purpose. So what else? Fishing and what else?
Two years ago, I got really into exercise, and I haven't fully dialed in my diet, but I do think that kind of dialing that in is a hobby in and of itself. So I think exercise has been it's a hobby that also like just releases everything in me. Mm-hmm. Long story short on the exercise, if you're in my life daily and you see me not exercise for 3 days, you should know that I am not going to be a happy camper the next day.
You get hangry, but whatever that is for exercise?
Yes. Okay. I get...
We need to coin a word.
We need to coin a word.
Yeah.
Hungrycise or no?
No. We'll figure it out. No, we'll figure it out and get back to you guys. Yeah. I started doing Muay Thai like 8 months ago.
Muay Thai?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Is that like BJJ?
So
Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu.
Yeah.
By the way.
Jiu-Jitsu is slightly different. So Muay Thai is more like the fighting style, where Jiu-Jitsu is grappling. But it's been so great. And it's a family.
Yeah.
But I also die a little bit every time. So it's an hour and a half class. And I die.
An hour and a half for fighting is crazy. I did boxing for a bit.
A little bit every time. But it's such a phenomenal way to just get out a little bit of aggression. It's a good cardio. And it's also just such a great gym. So, So Ohana Warrior Gym. In Richardson, if anybody's interested.
Ohana Warrior Gym in Richardson.
Yeah, nice. If anybody is interested. And phenomenal place.
The one that I used to be a part of, I was only a part of it for about a year, but Fitness Fight Factory, it's right next to Keller. I think it might be in Keller, but Fitness Fight Factory, look it up. That was a fight gym. Johnny Bedford, who was a bare knuckle champion.
Okay.
A couple of times, he runs that gym.
Oh, nice.
And I just had a wonderful experience. The only reason I stopped doing it is because I was going to my corporate job, and I was coming with black eyes and chin issues. And
they're like,
I was getting knocked out.
Should we call somebody?
But it was a good time. You know,
so we need to do a welfare check?
We thrive. We thrive. We go after it. The last thing I want to talk about is more of your spiel.
Oh, my gosh.
I am excited for this one.
Okay.
Starting your own podcast.
Yeah.
And her podcast is called...
How the Fuck Did We End Up Here?
How the Fuck Did We End Up Here?
Yeah. Yeah, which I, you know, realize is maybe counterintuitive to HR life. But it really is just kind of a raw, to your point, unedited, kind of like this conversation about everything. So it could be leadership. It could be, you know, what's happening with veterans, like transitioning back into work life, high school, you know, things that are happening with kids in high school. So I have, you know, a bunch of really great friends with the really diverse backgrounds, and I think they just bring such a phenomenal perspective to share with the world. So,
yeah. Awesome. For her future guests, though, for any inquiries, what should they reach out to?
They can reach out to me at my email. Right now, while I'm building everything out, which is summermoon76@gmail.com.
Okay. Awesome.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Summer. This has been So wonderful.
Yeah, this is fun.
Is there anything else that you would like the world to know, just to maybe help someone on a path that's struggling?
Gosh, it's, we're in such a, just such a weird time right now, and I know it's really, really difficult for a lot of people, and a lot of people are struggling mentally, financially, just wherever you may be at in life, but I encourage you to find somebody to talk to. Mm-hmm. Just whether that's a friend, it's somebody in a, you know, in a church or a mosque or whatever your religion might be, but finding somebody to talk to help you just navigate through things, email me, I'll talk to you.
Yeah. Me as well.
Yeah. But for I think just having somebody to talk to, whether you just need advice or guidance or just want to talk about things, you're not alone. Don't be by yourself. Let somebody help you, because you'll then turn around and help somebody else, because this is just, it's, we're all humans trying to do this life together.
Life sucks sometimes, but yeah. If we take care of ourselves, then mm-hmm. we sometimes we thrive when we mm-hmm. thought we wouldn't have thriven.
I love it. Done. Yep.
I do want to give one more resource, mm-hmm. North Texas Counseling. Look them up. If you're in the DFW area, look mm-hmm. them up. Wonderful therapists. Mm-hmm. I have personally been seeing someone there for better part of 4 years, 5 years maybe. So yes. Super helpful. Without North Texas Counseling, I would not have started this podcast. So yeah. Thank you all so much.
Cool.
Thank you, Summer.
Yeah, thank you.
I appreciate you so much. Yeah.